It's All Songs Considered from NPR Music. I'm Robin Hilton, and I'm here with Tom Heisinger. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Robin.
And as we near the end of 2018, we're looking back at some of the musicians we lost this year. There were so many, including composer Johan Johansson, Marty Balin of Jefferson Airplane, a country artist Roy Clark, and Scott Hutchison, the singer of the band you're hearing now, Frightened Rabbit. The crumpled ocean is no boat trail. The dark water stole my clothing. The shape stirs beneath me. Scott Hutchison of Frightened Rabbit. This song is called The Wrestle, and it's from the band's 2010 album, The Winter of Mixed Drinks. And Scott disappeared in May after leaving a very cryptic note on his Twitter account that said, "Be so good to everyone you love. It's not a given. I'm so annoyed that it's not. I didn't live by that standard, and it kills me. Please hug your loved ones. I'm away now, and thanks." And then Scott's body was found a couple days later. No official cause of death was given, but it is believed that he took his own life.
There were far too many other musical voices that fell silent in 2018. We lost jazz pianists like Randy Weston, conductors like Jesus Lopez Cobos, opera singers, rockers, jazz club impresarios, record store kingpins like Russ Solomon of Tower Records, steel pan drum pioneers, composers like Oliver Nussen, producers like Jeff Emmerich. But by far, the one I think that reverberated the most, really, around the world was the loss of the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day,
I don't know how you begin to memorialize someone who's had the kind of impact she had on music for as long as she did, but here to help us try to do that is NPR Music's Anastasia Tsilkas. Hey, Anastasia.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Tom.
Anastasia, you've got a special take on what Aretha meant to us both musically and really as a nation. You covered her funeral, and you were actually there in Detroit as that long and wonderful funeral unfolded. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was one of the reporters who was called to Detroit to be there for some of the viewings. It was several days of public viewings. And then at her incredible, remarkable, once-in-a-lifetime experience of her homegoing service, her memorial service. And then at the end of this year, I also covered the surprise release of one of the greatest music documentaries ever made, which was a film she made over 45 years ago called Amazing Grace. So yeah, this year has been all about Aretha for me and reflecting on her life's work. And being at the funeral and even before that at the viewings was an incredible experience because she was so very much of Detroit. And to be in her community, literally being at the church that her father was the minister of for many, many years, and then later her brother as well, and seeing community coming out, and not just from Detroit, but from all around America, literally, to come honor her was incredible. And then the experience of being at her funeral service was once in a lifetime. You know, I think a lot of Americans and people around the world shared in seeing this incredible cavalcade of musicians and politicians and public figures talk about her in really intimate ways. You know, Smokey Robinson singing and noting that he was her longest friend. You know, they grew up around the corner from each other. There was a real intimacy to that I don't think I may ever experience again in my lifetime.
And, you know, it was much more than just a going home memorial. I mean, it was a remembrance, a celebration, and kind of a transformational church service with incredible music performances.
Oh, absolutely. And from almost every corner of the musical galaxy, right? It was a service that was supposed to start at, I think, 9 or 9:30. I can't quite remember. It started close to 11, and I wound up walking out of the church at something like 8:30 that night, which was really a testament to how many people wanted to honor her. And, you know, it was everyone, as everyone knows, from Stevie Wonder to Ariana Grande to Gladys Knight to Shirley Caesar, Jennifer Holliday, Fantasia. You can just go on and on and on. And of course, you know, the cavalcade of politicians and social justice figures as well. Everyone came to pay tribute in a really remarkable way.
There were several distinct periods in Aretha Franklin's career. She started off with Columbia in the early to mid-60s, and then she had her Atlantic years. Maybe, Anastasia, you can just tell us some of the highlights that defined those periods for her.
Sure. I mean, you know, she was first signed as really a jazz artist.
Moon River, water than mine, I'm crossing you in style someday.
I think that's something you hear throughout her career is this effortless improvisation and an effortless interplay with either herself at the piano or with her accompanying musicians that really comes out of that. And of course, then there's the huge punch of everything she did at Atlantic, you know, when she became Aretha Franklin. It was just string after string of singles, hit singles, and iconic songs. You know, you think of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman or Respect or anything from that era, because it's part of our culture in such a deep way. Then she went on to explore other things. She, you know, she had sort of a pop R&B feel for a while. She collaborated with Lauryn Hill. I think it is incredibly important to think about how much the gospel music she grew up with and the gospel music that she personified was a part of her at every stage in her career. You know, it was something that her family said, that gospel music, no matter what she sang, gospel music was really a part of her. And I think personally, I think she sanctified everything she sang.
Is there a song that really highlights her gospel roots for you?
Well, one that I keep coming back to, Robin, is what wound up as the first track on the album version of Amazing Grace, which is the spiritual Mary, Don't You Weep.
And that was a song that you also heard at the Going Home Memorial. I watched it on television and came in during Yolanda Adams and Bishop Paul Morton's performance of Mary, Don't You Weep, and it just blew the roof off the place. But here it is from Aretha's gospel record.
Jesus said, for the benefit of you who don't believe.
And this is Mary, Don't You Weep from Amazing Grace that came out in 1972. This is the audio recording that the documentary that's coming out now, Amazing Grace, they are one and the same. And you've actually already seen this documentary.
I've seen it three times already.
What can you say about it?
So this film documentary, which was originally meant to be directed by Sidney Pollack, the great filmmaker, was supposed to be a documentary of the recording that she made, this incredible gospel album, Amazing Grace. And the film had sort of a very troubled history. Sidney Pollack was still a pretty green director at that point, and he didn't sync up the visuals with the audio, and there were something like 20 hours of footage that couldn't be matched up. And Pollack told people that he dreamed of revisiting the material and salvaging it, and he never did. And a younger guy who used to work at Warner A&R picked up the mantle and eventually put the film together. And it wasn't until after Aretha's death that the family signed off on releasing it, which is why it's only in 2018 that we're seeing the film. But Aretha wanted to record this album in a black church. She chose a community in Watts in Los Angeles, and I think it's really important to note that this was just a few years after the infamous Watts riots and this incredible period of social unrest, that this community was sort of coming together, and I would go so far as to say healing with the help of this recording session. And in these sessions, Aretha is surrounded by people who know her and understand her. There's incredible backing choir, which was directed by the Reverend James Cleveland, who had formerly served as the minister of music at Aretha's father's own church. So he knew her and this tradition all together, and he was a gospel music giant in his own right. It's very much of its time and place and integrally linked. And these are musicians who knew Aretha and knew American gospel music inside and out. This was a community of believers in a lot of ways, and it's a documentary that brings together believers professing their faith and their faith in each other in incredibly powerful ways. And Aretha is just incandescent.
And I think it's fair to say that she was an artist that explored almost every genre of music, it seems. And one of my favorite Aretha moments was from the Grammy telecast in 1998, a total surprise when tenor Luciano Pavarotti was supposed to sing Nessun Dorma, and at the last minute, his doctors said, no, don't sing. His friend Aretha Franklin was backstage and said, I'll do it. Just let me listen to Pavarotti's rehearsal tape. She listened to the tape, and she got out there in front of the microphone after Sting introduced her. And what she did with the operatic aria is just nothing short of extraordinary, because she made it her own soulful version. And I just like to just listen to the very end of the aria. Is a single word, vincerò, that gets repeated. And the first thing she does with the word, she sweetly pushes it up. And then she ratchets up the heat, and then it's like we're in church. It's amazing.
And the amazing thing, Tom, about that is that vincerò means I will win. And I frankly can't think of anything more appropriate in that moment, because she does so thoroughly conquer this opera.
Oh, totally. And everyone just screams. It's just it's really an amazing moment.
We talked a whole lot more about Aretha Franklin's life and career and her impact on just about everything back when she passed away in August with Lauren Onkey of NPR Music and Ann Powers. We look at her entire life from her childhood all the way through her career, and you can that's still online if you want to go back and listen to that. Thanks, Anastasia.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Tom, we've lost so many artists this year, we couldn't begin to talk about all of them on a single episode. But one that I definitely want to talk about is Richard Swift. He passed away in July. He was just 41 years old. And Richard Swift is the kind of artist a lot of people didn't realize they knew.
You know, right.
He was a lot more influential and a lot more present in the music that a lot of people listened to than a lot of people may have realized. He put out nearly 24 solo albums and EPs over a span of about 15 years, but he was also a producer. He worked on a number of memorable albums by people like Damian Jurado and Nathaniel Rateliff, Foxygen and Kevin Morby, Valerie June,
right.
And so many more.
Played with the Black Keys and the Shins.
Yeah, he was a highly sought-after studio musician. And I always thought of him as sort of the secret sauce for a lot of the more interesting music that I have loved over the last 15 years or so. I would inevitably fall in love with some piece of music, dig into it, and find out there's Richard Swift again.
The production is just so elegant and so thoughtful, and not that it's overdone, but it just it's quirky. You're going to find a trumpet here and there, some jangly guitars, and maybe a kind of a honky-tonk piano. It's
very expansive sound, too, very roomy feel. He was always playing around with sound and form, and not to the point of being wildly experimental, but he just could take a standard song and sort of bend everything out of focus. I want to play a little bit of a song called Bowling Trophies from Foxygen's We Are the 21st Century Ambassadors of Peace and Magic, one of the records he produced. You know, it's kind of messy and kind of trippy. There's a lot going on in it, and he just loved sound, and he loved playing around with it. We first heard that Richard Swift was suffering from some sort of illness in late June, and his friend started a crowdsourcing funding page to help raise money for whatever it was, and then about 2 weeks later, he was dead, and we later learned that he had a serious drinking problem. His family was very open about it in the end and wanted people to know. And he ended up suffering from multiple organ failure from his drinking.
And then there was a record that came out after he passed, right?
Yeah, his final one that was a real surprise, we didn't know it was coming, came out in September, The Hex. I think the name of the record says a lot about how he may have been feeling about his life. And on this record, you know, he gets into it. He sings about his battles with depression and anxiety and alcoholism. And
right.
He addresses his family directly by individuals' names.
Right, a song about Nancy, his sister, who had died.
Yeah. Yep. I think there comes a point late in the record where I kind of feel like it's almost like you're witnessing the moment when he realizes, you know what, I don't think I'm actually going to make this. And and that he realizes he's nearing the end of his life. I want to play the closing cut to the album, the last song on the record, called September 20th.
Calling out, can't hear your name. Gotta get away, gotta get away. When I go out alone. Everybody knows I'll be safe in my home. Death to us part, sickness and hate.
It's really quite simple instrumentation, but it sounds so lush and so well produced. And there's a lot on this posthumous album, Hex, that is just pretty amazing. Like the song Broken Finger Blues, which has this 60s soul Delphonics kind of sound to it with the reverb and the falsetto singing. Again, the piano there, which is kind of like a barroom piano.
Yeah.
You were mentioning earlier that you thought that this song was kind of maybe a point where you could see inside his head a little bit. And I was actually thinking of that song called The Million Dollar Baby from Dressed Up for the Letdown. There's a line in there that says, I wish I was dead most of the time, but I don't really mean it.
Yeah, he definitely battled a lot of inner demons. And I guess the only other thing I would say about Richard Swift is that I had the pleasure of meeting him a handful of times, and he was just a sweet, kind, beautiful soul. And I really miss him, and so many people do. I hope that people continue to discover his music in the years to come.
Well, someone, Robin, I wish I could have met but never did, who passed in October, was Montserrat Caballé, the great opera diva. She was really, I think, one of the last of the old school divas, and I think above all, she's going to be remembered for the sheer beauty of her voice. I mean, I think you could call it extreme beauty, don't you think?
Honestly, like last night I was preparing for this show and I was so fried and I could just barely keep my eyes open, and I hit a wall, and then I thought, well, I'll just listen to this real quick. And honestly, within seconds, everything just started to melt away. Less than a minute into it, I realized, like, tears were kind of streaming down my face. It was just this beautiful, beautiful release. And it's not just a pretty voice. There's some emotion. There's like an X factor to her.
There are a lot of pretty voices out there. Hers might be the prettiest, but she also has the coloring and the drama, the acting with the voice. But another thing I think is her legacy is breath control. I mean, any singer today can listen to almost anything she does and have an object lesson in how to fully support tones and the musical line over long stretches of notes. And we'll listen to an example of that in a second. But she, like other old school singers, she sang just about everything, a really wide variety of these kind of like crushingly difficult, florid bel canto style roles that we call them, from like Bellini and Donizetti and early Verdi to heavier things like Strauss's Salome, lighter Mozart, and these Spanish operettas that are called zarzuelas that she loved so much. Pulitzer-winning critic and journalism professor Tim Page once told me that Caballé's voice was the single most gorgeous sound he had ever heard from any human. So let's sample a little bit more of that beauty right now. And here, it's going to take 23 seconds to convince you of the amazing breath control this woman had. It's part of the opening recitative, the section that precedes this formal aria called D'Amor sull'Ali Rosa from Verdi's Il Trovatore. So here's what to listen to. This is what she does. On a single breath, she rises effortlessly to this sweet B-flat on the word pietosa, which means pitiable, and then floats a seemingly endless, creamy, silvery ribbon of perfectly supported tone on the word sospiri, which is appropriate because it means sighs, and you're just left breathless. That's Montserrat Caballé singing from Verdi's Il Trovatore. And how she keeps that thread of tone so perfectly focused is a minor miracle, I swear. And you can bet, you know, those soft tones can be heard all the way up to the upper balcony. And that's what's amazing about it.
She was 85 years old. She grew up poor and taught herself to sing when she was a child.
8 years old, she taught herself how to sing an aria from Puccini's Madame Butterfly.
And she continued to sing and perform well into her 70s. Did you ever have the pleasure of seeing her perform?
Oh, no, I wish I had. But, you know, fortunately, she has left us with a lot of great recordings. Let's just hear one more example. It's really from the same aria, how she ends it. We heard how she began it. Let's hear how she ends it. And it's a really great trill. And again, this endless supply of breath to close it out with this diaphanous scrim of sound. Wow. Montserrat Caballé, you know, like a lot of opera singers, Robin, she dabbled in crossover, and she teamed up with Freddie Mercury of Queen in this song and an album called Barcelona. And Barcelona was close to her heart because she was born there, and opera being pretty close to Freddie Mercury's heart when you listen to songs like Bohemian Rhapsody. And they made this song called Barcelona, which after Freddie Mercury's death in 1991 was featured in the 92 Summer Olympics in Barcelona. And the track surged way up to the top of the charts in Britain and in Europe. So let's have just a little taste, very campy duet here with Freddie Mercury of Queen and Montserrat Caballé. Barcelona.
Montserrat Caballé with Freddie Mercury. She was one of the last old school divas, yeah.
She had everything. She had the voice, she had the drama.
We have to take a short break, but we'll have more right after this.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Squarespace. If you're ready to start your new business, get your unique domain and create a beautiful website with help from Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support. Head to squarespace.com/songs for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SONGS to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. Support also comes from Hinge. Hinge is the dating app that's great at one thing, setting you up on great dates. And they're not just saying that. On Hinge, 3 out of 4 first dates lead to second dates. They are the number one mobile first dating app mentioned in the New York Times wedding section. So if you're looking for a BFF, a job, a pen pal, or a hookup, Hinge isn't the place for you. Hinge is exclusively designed to get you out on great dates. Download Hinge in the Apple Store or Google Play.
It's All Songs Considered from NPR Music. I'm Robin Hilton. I'm here with Tom Heisinger.
Hey, Robin.
And we're looking back at some of the beloved artists we lost in 2018. So many were just way too young. We talked about Richard Swift and Scott Hutchinson. There was the Swedish DJ Avicii, who died at the age of 28. We're going to talk about Mac Miller a little bit later on in the show, but I want to talk now about Dolores O'Riordan, who was the singer for the band The Cranberries. She died in January, and she was only 46 years old. And The Cranberries was this pop and rock band from Ireland, and there was a time back in the early to mid-90s when they were one of the biggest bands in the world. They sold tens of millions of records, and for people my age especially, I think, when they think of The Cranberries, this is the first song that you think of.
You got me wrapped around your finger.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the big Cranberries, and one of the early hits, Linger. Dolores O'Riordan, we're talking about her, and she passed earlier this year. She was the co-writer of that song, and she wrote it about being rejected in a love affair, and she said she never thought it would be a big hit.
O'Riordan said on more than one occasion that she felt very awkward and even said unattractive. She felt unattractive as a young woman, and this song is about that awkward first kiss and the feeling of being rejected. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this song is that it brought the band tremendous fame. And she found herself the focus of more attention than she ever imagined she'd have in her life. And she really wasn't ready for it. She struggled a lot. Linger shows sort of the breezier, wistful pop side of the band.
Right.
But you can hear them get a lot louder and darker on another hit for them that was called Zombie.
Zombie. Cranberries, of course, with lead singer Dolores O'Riordan. And Robin, remember when they sang that at the Tiny Desk a few years ago?
The band had about a 10 to 15 year run, and then they went on hiatus, and they eventually got back together and put a record out in 2012, which was their first in more than a decade. It was called Roses, and that was the record they were touring behind when they came to the Tiny Desk. They had another album called Something Else in 2017. And we are expected to have another album out sometime next year, which will be Dolores O'Riordan's last, but just a beautiful, beautiful voice, and another beloved artist just gone much too soon.
I know, and you watch that Tiny Desk, and it's pretty amazing to think she's not with us anymore. And someone else who isn't around any longer with his music and a very different sound from the Cranberries and Dolores O'Riordan, I think we could say, is the pianist Cecil Taylor, who was 89 when he passed away. Taylor's probably the first name in avant-garde jazz piano. And what he coaxed out of that box of wire and wood is just amazing. A dazzlingly wide range of color and texture, these fierce banging attacks and thick cluster chords gathering into thunderclouds. And he was doing all this beginning, in the mid to late 50s, really quite ahead of his time.
Can you imagine stepping into a club back then? You wouldn't even know what to make of it.
No, a lot of people didn't, and throughout his career, a lot of people really never understood him. Ben Ratliff, the former New York Times jazz critic, said, "Cecil is of jazz and beyond it," and I think that's really true. Taylor challenged kind of what we all thought of as jazz and what we think of as music in a way, and he was classically trained. He used some of his love and knowledge of classical music, I think, in his own compositions, which were very rigorously structured. He told Nat Hentoff one time, "I'm not afraid of European influences. The point is to use them, like Ellington did, as a part of my life as an American Negro." Let's hear a little, I guess I would call this kind of medium ferocious Cecil Taylor. It's jazz, but it's probably just not in the traditional jazz structures. A piece called Mountain Eyes from when he appeared on Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz in 1987.
And it wasn't always fireworks with him. I think there was a lot of nice push and pull going on in his range. It wasn't always the heavy cluster chords.
No, he could have periods of kind of challenging stasis in some of his pieces. I mean, he started out actually not so ferocious, but he just moved in this path throughout his career. His first noodlings at the piano came with lessons from his mom when he was six. And then he went to what is what used to be called the New York College of Music, and then New England Conservatory, began making records in the mid-50s. And then in the 1970s, I guess no one could really teach what he was playing, so he taught it himself. He had some teaching positions at the University of Wisconsin and in Ohio. Later, too, he started reciting his own poems at his performances. In 1994, Cecil Taylor said, "What I'm doing is creating a language, a different American language." And I see his legacy as a legacy that really freed musicians up, paved the way for people to think outside the box, as they say. And I think you can hear that kind of playing in some of today's pianists, from Vijay Iyer, Ethan Iverson, Robert Glasper, people like that. I think they have a debt to pay to the challenging world of Cecil Taylor.
One of the things that helped me understand the language that he was speaking at the piano is his love of dance, of ballet, and modern dance. And he said at one point that he's trying to recreate the sounds of the dancers in the air. Those movements that they make when they're in the air, that's what he's trying to do, recreate at the keys.
Right. Again, that creating some kind of new language. Amazing.
We've got just one more artist that we want to highlight for this In Memoriam edition of All Songs Considered, but so many others that we should at least mention. There was Mikiko Fujioka, who was the guitarist for the band Baby Metal, the Japanese metal band. Marky Smith, the singer of The Fall, also passed away this past year.
Right. There was George Walker, who was born right here in Washington, D.C. in 1922. He was a pioneering composer. A man of firsts, really. The first African-American to win a Pulitzer in 96. The first African-American pianist to play a recital at New York's Town Hall in 1945. He was 96 years old and left us with a lot of amazing compositions.
We should also mention the jazz trumpeter Roy Hargrove.
He was just 49, way too young. Our jazz critic Nate Chenin called him the brightest promise of his jazz generation. Mm-hmm. I think we should also make a shout out to just a couple more. Kyra Arby, the strong voice singer from Mali, who sang these socially conscious songs of great power and even more powerful grooves. She was just 59. That's also far too early. And then a bravo for Charles Aznavour, the French singer, songwriter, and actor whose fame reached way beyond France, sold, get this, more than 100 million records in 80 countries.
Wow.
Not bad. Acted in 60 films. Sometimes called the French Frank Sinatra, but actually I'm not sure that's fair because he was really very much his own artist.
All right, one final artist that we want to highlight for this In Memoriam edition of All Songs Considered. We're going to go out on Mac Miller, and here to talk about him is NPR Music Sydney Madden.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Mac Miller died in September, was just 26 years old.
Yeah, very young. Mac Miller, he was a Pittsburgh rapper who died of an accidental overdose on September 7th, and that was just a month shy of dropping his fifth studio album, Swimming.
And it was just about a month after that he came here to our offices and did an amazing tiny desk.
Yeah, absolutely. A crazy tiny desk with strings, a bass section, courtesy of his friend Thundercat. It was a beautiful performance, and now it's been part of memorializing him.
He was only 26, but this is something that he actually had been doing a long time. He started really young.
Mac was an old soul in some ways and a lover of hip-hop his entire life. He started releasing music when he was just 16, 17, 18, and he really came up around 2010, 2011, which is the tail end of MySpace music and, you know, blog era hip-hop. Mm-hmm. He made his name locally in Pittsburgh on the label Rostrum Records. He was a millennial internet baby. He was someone who would drop a tape, whether it was under his old moniker, which was Easy Mac, or something new, and the internet would go crazy. His artistry developed a lot over time, and you can hear that development early with this 2010 track called Kool-Aid and Frozen Pizza.
Hey, Kool-Aid and frozen pizza. It's the work of art, I ain't talking Mona Lisa. Dream of rocking crowds, see me filling up arenas. This weed got me laughing like a damn hyena. Yeah, I live a life pretty similar to yours. Used to go to school, hang with friends and play sports. Every single summer taking trips to the shore. And that was all gravy, but I knew I wanted more. Ain't ever seen a young rapper like one. Can't believe they asked where it's just a mirage. Still got my training wheels in the garage, but I ain't gonna need.
This track, Kool-Aid and Frozen Pizza, it's off his 2010 breakthrough mixtape, Kids, and it's a nice encapsulation of his sound when he first came out. You know, it's in that boom-pap tradition, it's showing off his consistent flow, and he's rapping about something relatable, which is being bored on a summer day during summer vacation. That was Mac's niche at the time. He had songs about getting a new pair of Nikes, enjoying senior skip day. He was doing things that were relatable and that he wasn't trying to be something he's not, you know?
And you mentioned him being kind of an old soul. His sound was a real throwback, too. He cited, like, Lauryn Hill and Beastie Boys as big influences.
Yeah, he loved Tribe. He loved the Beastie Boys. He loved Far Side, I want to say. He had a lot. He had a wide-ranging taste. He was trained on piano and the drums when he was young. So he was a musician from the time he was a baby as well. But then over time, from 2010 to 2018, you really hear and see the musicianship and his growth as an artist. Case in point, there's a song called What's the Use off his latest album that he actually performed at the Tiny Desk, which has twinges of pop and funk and soul, and it still meshes in his hip-hop authenticity.
Never superficial, you gon' know it when it hits you. Get a little sentimental when I'm off the juice, yeah. Yeah, okay, we caught it in the breeze, but the breeze ain't flowing like me, motherfucker. Hold up, you don't need to hold up. And I can show you what it seems, what it is, what it truly might be. Nothing that you know of, you don't need to hold up.
And that's Mac Miller playing What's the Use from his album Swimming, but this is the recording from his Tiny Desk performance. And one of the things I love about this performance is you see is the smile on his face. Mm-hmm. You just see how much fun he's having.
Especially with his friend and with the band. You know, he was someone who sometimes he toured with a DJ, sometimes he toured with background singers. He loved musicianship and the art of collaboration. And I think that's going to be a big part of his legacy. Not only that he was a great producer, a great rapper. He was an aficionado of collaboration and cooperation. He had a producer moniker, Larry Fisherman, and if you look up the discography of many of your prominent pop, R&B, and hip-hop artists, he's all over other people's albums.
Yeah, it's interesting that he decided to have an alternate identity for that and not take the credit.
Well, I think that's something that's very important about him. I think that Mac Miller kind of proved that there can be enormous generosity in hip-hop, which is a genre that really kind of born out of competition and one-upmanship, and I think he really paid attention to the up-and-comers and helping them.
That's a great point. He found a lot of success early in his career. With his first and second albums, he was doing countrywide tours for like years at a time, and he brought people like Chance the Rapper on his first national tour.
So how is the hip-hop world actually reacting to this really sudden and tragic passing?
There are a lot of younger rappers who are just a few years younger than Mac, but who really are inspired by him. They've eulogized him in song. People have got in-memoriam tattoos. There was a big in-memoriam concert, and now he just earned a posthumous Grammy nomination. Swimming has been nominated for Best Rap Album.
Right.
But yeah, one of the reasons his death was so surprising is because even though his drug addiction was kind of known, it wasn't the emphasis of his persona, the way you think about some other rappers. Like, if I say Snoop Dogg, what do you think of?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know? So he tended to rap about his recovery and his backslides with a sense of sincerity and almost admirable honesty. It's also surprising because he died right in the middle of his artistic development. He wasn't a new face in the game, and he wasn't a legacy artist, and I would argue that he wasn't even at his pinnacle yet. We have 5 great studio albums from him, but I don't think any of them really count as his magnum opus.
And I think it's just heartbreaking. You talk about him rapping about his issues, and when you watch the Tiny Desk performance of the last tune that he played, 2009,
yeah,
really a song of transformation, and some of the lyrics there are, I struck the F out and then came back swinging, and then I was digging me a hole big enough to bury my soul, demons as big as my house. But then also these lovely lines like, nowadays all I do is shine and take a breath and ease my mind.
Right. It seemed like he was digging himself out of that dark hole,
right,
that dark place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't need to lie no more. Nowadays all I do is shine, take a breath and ease my mind. Yeah. She don't cry no more. She tell me that I get her high cause an angel's supposed to fly. And I ain't asking why no more. No, I take it if it's mine, I don't stay inside the lines. It ain't 2009 no more. Yeah, I know what's behind that door. Okay, you gotta jump in to swim.
He's an artist who was a huge loss in the hip-hop community, and I think he's an artist whose legacy will continue to blossom after his death because he was very in the middle of his career. It's like, what could have been?
Well, I doubt Swimming is the last album we'll ever get from Mac Miller, or at least recordings that we'll ever
yeah,
hear from
him. I'm sure there's a lot of posthumous material out there.
Hope so.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Sydney.
Thank you, guys.
And Robin, it is sad when you contemplate the hundreds of really great musicians that we lost, and I kind of think doing a show like this, it reminds me of, like, you know, the Oscar telecast where they have that one point in the telecast where they do the montage,
right,
of all the actors and producers and people behind the scenes that we lost. And it's always so sad, but yet I always look forward to it because it reminds us of the great art that these people have been giving us.
For sure. And this is only obviously a handful of the artists we lost this year. And if you go to our website, npr.org/music, you can read about these artists and a whole lot more of the beloved creators and creative people that we lost in 2018. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Robin.
For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. I'm Robin Hilton.
Oh no, I take it if it's mine. I don't stay inside the lines. It ain't 2009 no more. Yeah, I know what's behind that door.